This is Audible.
BBC presents Agatha Christie, a radio portrait of the celebrated authoress and playwright.
The intense interest aroused in the public by what was known at the time as the Stiles case has now somewhat subsided. Nevertheless, in view of the worldwide notoriety which attended it, I have been asked, both by my friend Poirot and the family themselves, to write an account of the whole story. This, we trust, will effectually silence the sensational rumours which still persist.
Those were the opening sentences of Agatha Christie's first detective novel, written more than 30 years ago. With the publication of The Mysterious Affair at Stiles, and our first meeting with Hercule Poirot, the engaging little Belgian detective with the egg-shaped head and outsized moustache, there began one of the most remarkable careers in the history of fiction. Poirot won for himself a world public comparable with that of Holmes and Father Brown, and his creator's books have sold by the million in Britain, the United States, and elsewhere. Since the Stiles case, there have been between 50 and 60 other mysterious affairs, superbly contrived, brilliantly told. As if this were not enough, Mrs. Christie became the first woman dramatist ever to have three successful plays running in the West End simultaneously. Yet what, after all, do her countless readers know of Agatha Christie? Her book sales are fabulous, and yet less is known of her than of probably any other famous writer of popular fiction. Her father was American by birth, but she was born in Devonshire and was encouraged to write by that great West Country novelist, Eden Philpotts. But let Agatha Christie speak for herself and tell us about her work.
People often ask me what made me take up writing. Many of them, I fancy, wonder whether to take my answer seriously, although it's a strictly truthful one. You see, I put it all down to the fact that I never had any education. Perhaps I'd better qualify that by admitting I did eventually go to school in Paris when I was 16, or thereabouts. But until then, apart from being taught a little arithmetic, I'd had no lessons to speak of at all. Although I was gloriously idle, in those days children had to do a good many things for themselves. They made their own dolls' furniture, and they made Christmas presents to give to their friends. Nowadays they're just given money and told to buy their presents in a big store. But I found myself making up stories and acting the different parts, and there's nothing like boredom to make you write. So by the time I was 16 or 17, I'd written quite a number of short stories and one long, dreary novel. By the time I was 21, I'd finished the first book of mine ever to be published, The Mysterious Affair at Stiles. I'd sent it to one or two publishers who didn't want it, and eventually it went to John Lang. About a year later, I heard it had been accepted. Well, that's how it began, and since that time, I've written something like 55 books and half a dozen plays.
The Mysterious Affair at Stiles set the pattern for the methods and manner of the volatile little Belgian in the many Poirot mysteries that were to be unfolded year by year.
Poirot, uttering a hoarse and inarticulate cry and putting his hands over his eyes, swayed backwards and forwards, apparently suffering the keenest agony.
Good heavens, Poirot, what is the matter? Are you ill?
No. It is that I have an idea.
Oh, one of your little ideas?
Oh, my friend, no. This time it is an idea gigantic, stupendous. And you, my friend, have given it to me. Look, the final proof, the last link of the chain, is now in my hands. A letter in a murderer's own handwriting, mes amis. Let me read it to you. Dearest Evelyn, you'll be anxious at hearing nothing. It is all right, only it will be tonight instead of last night. You understand? There's a good time coming once the old woman is dead and out of the way. No one can possibly bring home the crime to me. That idea of yours about the bromides was a stroke of genius, but we must be very circumspect. A false step. Here, my friends, the letter breaks off. Doubtless the writer was interrupted, but there can be no question as to his identity. We all know his handwriting.
It's all done.
And we... Mesdames, messieurs, let me introduce you to the murderer.
Poirot's first recorded case sold well, especially in view of the fact that it was the first attempt of a completely unknown woman writer. Her first publisher was John Lane, and by one of life's happier circumstances, his nephew, Sir Alan Lane, was later to play a big part in the Agatha Christie story. For Sir Alan founded the amazingly popular library of Penguin Books, and was to increase the Christie circulation by more than 5 million copies.
I remember very clearly when that book, The Mysterious Affair of Styles, was published by my uncle John Lane at the Bodley Head. My reaction wasn't exactly a critical one, far from it. I didn't read it as a publisher, because at that time I happened to be the office boy. I devoured it as I devoured my weekly blood. I enjoyed it. The probability is that I should have enjoyed it a great deal more if I had known that one day my own firm would print and sell, which is more to the point, between 5 and 6 million books by this author. We were going to become close friends with a lot of common interests. My wife and I were to spend memorable times with Agatha and Max, her husband, in the Mesopotamian desert. But these pleasant happenings were hidden from me. I had just read about this mysterious affair in the intervals of licking stamps and being more or less polite to visitors, and thought it was a jolly good story. Years afterwards, 10 years perhaps, I met Agatha Christie again. She has lived most of her life in Devon. Devon is the home of my own family, and I found myself being invited to spend happy weekends at her home, first in Torquay, and then on the banks of the Dart. We have a lot of interests in common. Both of us are fond of old houses and old furniture. And over the years, we've traipsed all over the west of England together, popping in and out of antique shops. She is a great collector. I am just a minor one. I have lived with Agatha and her husband in the desert. I have stayed with them time and time again in the past 25 years. I know from her output alone that she is a prodigious worker. And yet, in all that time, wherever we've been, I have never yet heard the click of her typewriter. I've never seen her writing or typing, and in fact, I've never been conscious of her having done any work at all, in spite of the astonishing quantity and quality which she steadily produces. When we were with her in the little mud hut at Nimrud, she would be busy on the job of organizing the day-to-day work of the camp, and in the evenings, she'd be occupied by her sewing and needlework. What we didn't realize now was that while she was doing all these manifold things, some new Agatha Christie play or novel was being worked out in her mind. Whichever way you look at it, there's only one Agatha.
Agatha Christie was working as a dispenser in a Red Cross hospital during the First World War when she wrote The Mysterious Affair at Styles. It was published a year or two later, and from that time to the present day, the keys of the famous Christie typewriter have been tapping out a never-ending flow of novels, articles, short stories, and plays. Her fifth novel, The Murder of Roger Ackroyd, is still regarded by many people as her finest.
Ackroyd was sitting as I'd left him in the armchair before the fire. His head had fallen sideways, and clearly visible, just below the collar of his coat, was a shining piece of twisted metalwork. Parker and I advanced till we stood over the recumbent figure. I heard the butler draw in his breath with a sharp hiss. "Stamp from behind," he murmured. "Horrible."
The Murder of Roger Ackroyd, with its shattering surprise ending, was hailed as a classic of detective fiction. In a few years, Agatha Christie had become a highly skilled craftsman, and people were curious to know what her approach to the business of writing was.
Yes, I do find that one's friends are curious about the way one works. What is your method, they want to know. Well, the disappointing truth is that I haven't much method. I type my own drafts on an ancient but faithful machine I've owned for years, and I find a dictaphone useful for short stories or for recasting an act of a play, but not for the more complicated business of working out a novel. No, I think the real work is done in thinking out the development of your story and worrying about it until it comes right. That may take quite a while. Then when you've got all your materials together, as it were, all that remains is to try to find time to write the thing.
There is an altogether astonishing continuity about the Christie career. Almost exactly 30 years ago, Agatha Christie's agent sold a short story to the Grand Magazine, which has long since ceased publication, for what today would seem to be a very modest fee.
Mr. Mayhern adjusted his pince-nez and cleared his throat with a little dry-as-dust cough that was wholly typical of him. Then he looked again at the man opposite him, the man charged with willful murder.
The story was called Witness for the Prosecution, and on it was based the play of the same title, the play which, while still running successfully in London, became a hit in New York. So, turning for a moment to the Agatha Christie plays, let's hear Richard Attenborough, who starred in one of them, The Mousetrap.
I don't think I'll ever forget the first time I met Agatha Christie, and that's not just a figure of speech. To begin with, she's just about the last person in the world you would ever think of in connection with crime or violence or anything blood-curdling or dramatic. She's the calmest, gentlest, most charming and matter-of-fact character you can imagine. And the thought of her as probably the best-selling thriller writer of the day is frankly incredible. Some time ago, when my wife, Sheila Sim, and I were into Dorothea's Son, Peter Saunders told us that he had a play he wanted us to do, a play by Agatha Christie. And although we were obviously tied up and in a show that looked like running for quite a time, they said they'd wait until we were free, so could we give them some sort of date. Well, Sheila and I went into it pretty carefully and set a date some 15 months ahead, by which time we were sure that Dorothy would have ended. That was fine, and so the next thing was to meet the author. We'd read the play, of course, which at that time was called Three Blind Mice. I must say we were taken absolutely by surprise when we met this very sweet and delightful person. She was so kind and friendly, rather like the embodiment of everything one expects from the perfect aunt. But even then, I think we realized that she was very definitely someone who knew her own mind. For one thing, she was convinced that Sheila was absolutely right for the girl in the play, but I'm not at all certain that she thought I was quite right. At any rate, she said that I would be right for part of Sergeant Trotter, if not all of it. We were both very excited and told her we thought it was a most wonderful piece of theatre. And then, making an utterly typical remark, Mrs. Christie said, "Well, I think we ought to get quite a little run out of it." The three of us became the greatest of friends, but when we said goodbye after that lunch, we just couldn't get over the fact that this quite quiet, precise, dignified lady could possibly have made our flesh creep and fascinated people all over the world with her mastery of suspense and her gift for creating on the stage and the screen such an atmosphere of terror.
Yeah, what are you doing? Why have you turned out the light?
With her remarkable output of novels, short stories, and plays, even experienced writers wonder how on earth Mrs. Christie does it. She has her own answer.
It's difficult to say, but 3 months seems to me quite a reasonable time to complete a book, if one can get right down to it. On the other hand, plays, I think, are better written quickly. And of course, writing plays is much more fun than writing books. You haven't got to bother about long descriptions of places and people. or about deciding how to space out your material. And you must write pretty fast, to keep in the mood, and to keep the talk flowing naturally. I prefer to write a play as a play, that is, rather than to adapt a book. The only reason I ever did that was because I didn't care very much for what happened when other people tried to turn my books into plays. So, in the end, I had to do it myself.
Mrs. Christie has always held strong views about the way in which her characters have sometimes been recreated on the stage and screen. In one of her books, she has the character of a woman novelist who expresses these views.
You've no idea of the agony of having your characters taken and made to say things they never would have said and do things they never would have done. And if you protest, all they say is that it's good theatre.
One wonders what was her reaction to the film Renée Clair made of her story, Ten Little Niggers. The late Sir Aubrey Smith, Roland Young, and Barry Fitzgerald took part. In this scene, following a rapid and generous succession of murders, two of the survivors, each convinced that the other is the murderer, attempt to come to a mutual understanding across the billiard table.
Leave it on, Doctor, leave it on.
Throw you off your game, won't it, this flickering?
What's wrong, Doctor? Oh, I see. You and I, we are alone in the house. Please, give me a chance. If you are, Mr. Orne, for heaven's sake, tell me. I won't say a word to the others.
Don't torment me this way. If you want to kill the others, I won't interfere. I won't say a word. I'll even help you if you'll spare my life.
Look, I trust you. Don't you trust me?
Yes.
That's Maurice.
Don't come any closer! Stay where you are!
I shan't move an inch.
Neither will I. Till the light comes on.
Do you think it will?
Why not?
This is no accident. Someone wants this house to be dark tonight.
Who?
The one we fear. But my dear doctor, he's made a mistake. This trick of putting out the lights clears two people. You and me. Now we can trust each other.
I see. Yes, the idea was to keep us in fear of each other.
But now we can form an alliance, you and I.
And find the murderer.
But whatever Agatha Christie may have thought of her characters as portrayed on screen or stage, or indeed of her own fabulous success as a thriller writer, she found consolation in writing romantic novels under a different name. More than 20 years ago, reviewers discovered a new writer called Mary Westmacott. Christie fans had no idea of the connection between the two authors. As Mrs. Christie says herself,
I get a great deal of pleasure in writing my Mary Westmacott books. I concealed Mary Westmacott's identity very successfully for nearly 20 years, but it's a secret no longer, and I can only say that writing a different type of story is my indulgence, and I enjoy it tremendously.
One remarkable quality of this prolific writer is her gift for detachment. She has many interests, not least archaeology. And Sir Mortimer Wheeler, himself a celebrated archaeologist and author, gives us this picture.
Agatha Christie. I think of her at a party, as it might be one of those episodes in her own novels or plays when the characters are assembled and the plot thickens. She is sitting a little to one side of the scene, dressed probably in brown, with a jewel of old fashion upon her corsage. Unlike the others, she has no wine glass beside her and obviously needs neither the stimulus nor the gesture which such provision assures to lesser folk. Beneath a wealth of grey hair, she looks upon the world with calm and kindly eyes, observant rather than inquisitive, and always with a twinkle or a smile in readiness. Her talk is easy and leisurely, enlivened now and then with an unanticipated flash of wit, but not in the full sense of the term, vivacious. She is essentially a shy presence, adding a wise geniality to the party rather than noticeably dominating it. This quality of reserve and quiescence seems to me to be also an integral quality of her writing. The characters and episodes, even the climaxes, emerge from her books and plays, much more like a plant growing than like the jigsaw puzzle with which they're sometimes compared. How many hours she spends at her desk, I do not know, but she finds ample time also for living and seeing. Presently, she will be climbing the great mounds which represent the famous Assyrian city of Nimrud in northern Mesopotamia, where her husband, Professor M.E.L. Mallowan, is to renew the excavations that have in recent years revealed so much of the history and craftsmanship of 26 centuries ago. And Agatha will be no idle bystander. She is a part of the expedition, alike its hostess and at home in its workshops. Years ago, her crime story, Murder in Mesopotamia, had just such a setting. And who knows what mystery still awaits her lively eye amidst those antique mounds and the ghosts of bygone kingdoms.
For one of her recent novels, Mrs. McGinty's Dead, Agatha Christie wrote this dedication. To Peter Saunders, in gratitude for his kindness to authors. Mr. Saunders, one of our best-known theatrical managers, is the man behind Mrs. Christie's successes on the West End stage and in New York.
Yes, I've had the good fortune to present Agatha Christie's extraordinary run of post-war successes in the West End, to say nothing of the current hit on Broadway. But what pleases me more than anything, you know, is the fact that our relationship is a far more friendly and a far happier one than that of just author and producer. I've seen perhaps as much as most people of her approach to work. I know from experience that remarkable facility she has for marshalling her ideas and scenes in her mind without putting pen to paper. I said to her once, "How's the new play going?" "It's finished," she told me. But when I asked, "May I read it?" she replied, so disarmingly, "Oh, I haven't written it." But she had given me a very strictly truthful answer. From her point of view, the play from beginning to end had been worked out to the last detail. The writing of it was an act of mere physical labour. I'd been taking round some of her plays on tour, although in fact I didn't meet Mrs. Christie until 1950. I think it may come as a surprise to some of her present-day admirers to realise that the words "By Agatha Christie" have been on Britain's playbills for something like 27 years. Alibi was the first. Black Coffee is still playing throughout the world. Then there was Love from a Stranger, Peddler at End House, Ten Little Niggers, which played for a year on Broadway, Appointment with Death, Murder on the Nile, and Murder at the Vicarage. At last, I was able to do what I'd always wanted and put on by myself a new play by Agatha Christie. This was The Hollow. It ran for 11 months, and with it began this fantastic four-year-long period of success in the West End, so that when 1955 began, her name was in lights outside three of London's famous theatres. And if that wasn't enough for one dramatist, there was a Broadway hit to her credit as well. Then after The Hollow, The Mousetrap, staged in 1952, is still cracking away in tremendous form, having put up the world's record for any thriller. Then to complete the triple achievement, we have Witness for the Prosecution, and for good measure, Margaret Lockwood in Spider's Web.
Usually you read all the books of your favourite author without a hope of ever meeting them. I can truthfully say I've been reading Mrs. Christie's mystery stories ever since I was at school. I haven't missed one of them. So you can imagine how I felt when the chance came to act in one of Agatha Christie's plays. And not just a play, but one she'd written specially for me. One day, Peter Saunders and Herbert DeLeon told me they had this idea of asking Mrs. Christie if she'd write a play for me. Before we met at lunch, I realized that although I'd loved reading her stories, I really had no idea how she would look. And like a good many others must have been, I was taken completely by surprise. She was utterly unlike anything I had remotely imagined. She was perfectly charming and we got on very well. But I couldn't help thinking of her in the setting of a country vicarage. We discussed the whole idea, and naturally, of course, it was to be a murder play. Then we talked for a while about the kind of character I should play, and Mrs. Christie vanished into Devonshire. 3 months later, the complete play arrived. I sent her a telegram right away to say how delighted I was with it. I couldn't do it for some time, of course, because I was making a picture, So the whole plan remained a deep, dark secret between the four of us until the first announcement was made in the press.
Witness for the prosecution, as you know, opened in New York a couple of days after Spider's Web had its first night in London and has turned out to be one of the biggest hits there for years.
The basic idea of Witness for the prosecution was in one of my very early short stories. I was very pleased indeed when my old friend Francis L. Sullivan was engaged for the New York production, and, of course, Patricia Jessel, who created the part here. Larry Sullivan played the part of my Belgian detective, Hercule Poirot, in Alibi more than 25 years ago.
Yes, it was in 1928 that I first played Monsieur Poirot in a touring company of Alibi, and it was through this that a couple of years later I made my first West End success in the same part in Black Coffee, and I again played him for a third time in Perrault End House in 1940. Although I met Mrs. Christie at rehearsals, and we had got on very well, I did not get to know her really intimately until the end of the war, when I approached her to write another play for me. My wife and I were living at Hazelmere in Surrey at the time, and Agatha came down to stay with us for several weekends whilst discussing what the play should be. On one of her weekend visits, I had an excellent chance to observe at least the outward manifestations of the creative phase of her work. At the back of the house, my wife, in a moment of insane optimism over the English weather, had caused a swimming pool to be made with half a dozen paths leading down to it through the chestnut woods. And one fine Sunday morning, I discovered Agatha wandering up and down these paths with an expression of intense concentration. I asked her what she was doing, but she was very uncommunicative, so I left her to it and dived into the pool. The sequel came about a year later when there arrived one day a copy of The Hollow with the printed dedication to Larry and Annie, with apologies for using their pool as the scene of a murder. Since I've been in America, we have kept up a correspondence, and I was delighted about 18 months ago when she sent me a copy of the play Witness for the Prosecution, with the suggestion that I might like to do it on Broadway. Although I loved the play personally, I'm ashamed to say that I had some doubts as to whether it would repeat its London success in New York, because I felt that it was very English, which might make it difficult to follow in places, especially in the court scenes, and also melodramatic, which is supposed to be unpopular here in New York. But I need have had no fears. The Duchess of Death, as an English critic once called her, has had an even bigger success here than in London, and I imagine the play will run for 2 years at least. Patricia Jessel, who repeats here the brilliant performance she created in London, tells me the audience reaction here is even better than in London. And every single critic, headed by the most redoubtable Brooks Atkinson of the New York Times, has passed out laudatory adjectives on both the play and Agatha Christie. Long may she flourish.
After that contribution from Francis L. Sullivan in America, a last word from the author of this program, Gail Pedrick.
Of all the scripts I've written in the past 25 years, 800 or 900 in all, this was one of the most interesting to do. But in one way, it puzzled and bothered me a little, just a little, and this is really most unusual. Now and again, you see, the picture seemed too good to be true. Her friends, one and all, think she is wonderful and say they will never forget the time they first met her. And I'm sure they mean it. True, there was more than a hint that she's a woman who knows her own mind and doesn't hesitate to speak it. But what an admirable quality. Then, we are told, she has a way of sitting in company, withdrawn and sometimes silent, and I suppose some people might find it exasperating to think she's plotting scenes of violence and villainy while they're talking their heads off about something else. But to be reserved, after all, is only shyness grown up. No, her friends love her and are under some happy, comfortable spell. All the same, the rest of us may be forgiven for wondering if the real Agatha Christie isn't rather more baffling than some of her characters.
That radio portrait of Agatha Christie was written for the BBC by Gail Pedrick. The narrator was John Webster, and the production was by Thurston Holland.
and the Great Orient Express steams away with a trainload of passengers, one of whom is to meet a violent, bloody, and well-planned death. The woman who thought it all up in the first place? Well, you've heard the name of the programme, so I don't have to tell you. Dame Agatha Christie, a lady as self-effacing as her novels are famous.
People often ask me what made me take up writing. Many of them, I fancy, wonder whether to take my answer seriously, although it's a strictly truthful one. You see, I put it all down to the fact that I never had any education.
The voice, and incidentally, a very rare recording of Dame Agatha herself. If someone were so foolhardy as to try and discover how many books she's sold, how many people have seen The Mousetrap, how much money she's made, how many people have been to the cinema to see her films, they'd rapidly get lost in the sheer weight of numbers. It's probably best to say, quite simply, that for as long as most people can remember, Dame Agatha, the lady who claims to have had no real education, has been delighting countless millions of readers and filmgoers and theatregoers with what was once called the gentle art of murder. And it is a gentle art. Dame Agatha is not the kind of lady to give you bad dreams because her crimes happen in such pleasant surroundings and among, apparently, the nicest kind of people. Anyway, back to Dame Agatha and her education, or lack of it.
I did eventually go to school in Paris when I was 16, or thereabouts. But until then, apart from being taught a little arithmetic, I'd had no lessons to speak of at all. Although I was gloriously idle, in those days, children had to do a good many things for themselves. They made their own dolls' furniture, and they made Christmas presents to give to their friends. Nowadays, they're just given money and told to buy their presents in a big store.
Finding a name for a programme isn't always as easy as it looks, so why call this one The Mysterious Dame Agatha? The answer, quite simply, is that, in her own way, she is a mysterious person. Quiet, self-effacing, and very definitely anti-limelight. Someone who has met her is the actor Nigel Stock, who appeared in one of her plays, not The Mousetrap, incidentally. He remembers both the play and the author.
It was called The Unexpected Guest. It was interesting from the point of view that the whole of the first act, which was divided up into two scenes, the first scene of which where only two people were involved. And this meant that you had to try and hold the audience in that first scene. And it was terribly important that you did, otherwise the play just went down the drain. That was the tough part of the play. The play actually was set in Wales, and I played a character called Michael Starkweather, who had been with an oil company in some part of Arabia, and who suddenly appeared in a house when there was a thick fog coming up from the Bristol Channel, and then discovered a corpse in the room.
And, as I said, Nigel Stock also remembers meeting the author after a somewhat abortive beginning.
Well, it was a fascinating experience. The first time when I really felt I was going to see her was at the reading of the play, which was at the Savoy Theatre, and Peter Saunders had presented this play, you see, and we all assembled there for the first time meeting one another, hoping that the lady was going to be present. But she sent a wire or a message which said she was unable to be present because she was making raspberry jam. So that was the first encounter, which didn't happen. But when it did happen, I was immediately spellbound, I think is the only word I can use. It sounds a little bit way up, but it really means that you know how you get an idea of somebody before you meet them. And when you do meet them, it's, in this case, completely and utterly wrong. This lady was shy, very gentle, very unassuming, and thoroughly charming. I was completely bowled over by her.
Peter Saunders, who staged the legendary Mousetrap, also recalls her shyness, which has in no way lessened the pleasures of her home life.
She is one of the most unforgettable characters I have ever met. She's desperately shy, this is no pose, and yet in her own home, she's very voluble. I've stayed with her several times in her beautiful home at Devonshire, and it's one of those country homes where you have large chintz armchairs, everybody's terribly friendly. When you come down to breakfast, there's nothing formal. The gong goes, but you come down just when you like, and you find eggs, bacon, kidneys, tomato, bacon on the sideboard on heated plates. You help yourself. If Agatha happened to be down, you say good morning, but she quickly disappears behind the newspaper, as you yourself do. And after breakfast, she'd say, well, everybody does whatever they want to do in this house. Most of us play cricket. Well, it seemed a rather odd pastime for this fairly middle-aged gathering, but this was because of her son, who was then only 8 years of age. And we used to play cricket in the nets they had there, and year after year he got older and older and more difficult to get out. And when he captained Eton at Lord's, well, we didn't get him out.
And besides the shyness?
She's somebody who has an enormous variety of interests. She used to go out to Baghdad and take all the colour slides for her husband, Sir Max Mallowan, who is an archaeologist of great distinction. She can talk about politics, she can talk about sport, and she does. There's nothing reticent about her among her own personal friends. It's with strangers that she seems to shy away. She dislikes personal publicity, and the fact that she's had an enormous amount is not of her own wish or doing. I've put on about 10 of her plays in the West End, and it is almost impossible to get her to meet the press. And it's sometimes a little embarrassing, because I tell the press that she'd rather not meet them, and then she might suddenly relent and do it on a personal basis, and I get blamed. There was one American journalist who was unable to get an interview with her, but happened to go to some function and met her in the ladies' lavatory. And she introduced herself as a journalist and asked one or two questions there and got a very good interview out of it.
Her shyness was something which certainly struck Julian Simmons, himself the author of some highly successful detective novels.
Personally, Agatha Christie is quite genuinely and absolutely shy. People often say that they're shy when, in fact, it isn't true. But she is an extremely difficult person to get to know. I wouldn't claim that I've got to know her at all well. On the other hand, once doing an interview with her with a tape recorder, which I took along, my inefficiency with the tape recorder was such as to break the barrier of shyness. And she revealed all sorts of things to me that she doesn't generally say, such as that she very much prefers Miss Marple to Poirot. If they write to me, she said, they write and say how much I must love him, if they only knew, and so on. In general, Agatha Christie is so shy that, for example, she's the president of a group of crime writers called the Detection Club, but she only became the president on the basis that she wouldn't on any account make even the shortest speech of the yearly dinners.
How does Julian Simmons regard her as a writer?
I should call her a sort of Cleopatra of the home counties, a serpent of old Thames, in the sense that all her characters seem to come from the home counties. They don't always. Sometimes they're to be found in Mesopotamia, as she calls it in one book. But essentially, that's what they are. They're essentially all middle class. The murderer will certainly be found from among that social group. Now, within that rather limited context, she employs the most dazzling ingenuity. In a way, this is the sort of detective story that I don't like very much. And yet she does it so marvellously, she does it so brilliantly, she pulls the wool over a reader's eyes so skillfully that one's got to admire it, and in my case, one's got to like it.
Does she have any faults, then?
She's got lots of faults, of course, so we all have. I suppose her chief fault, which has been pointed out by a lot of people, is being a tremendously slapdash writer in the literal grammatical sense. I don't much mind about this. I think these faults are obviously not cancelled, but they're certainly balanced by the virtues of writing often really quite brilliant dialogue, I think. Dialogue which hasn't actually been assessed at its proper value. This is being rather pompous. I wouldn't claim, nor no more would she claim, tremendously high literary virtues for her work. But I think they've got, I think it's got more virtues than people have given it credit for.
One question, of course, which has to be asked and probably can't be answered, is the success of her play, The Mousetrap. Why has this play of all plays had such a phenomenal run? Peter Saunders was asked if he had any idea when he staged it that it would go on and on and on.
I thought it would be a success, and then when I managed to get Richard Attenborough and Sheila Sims signed up, I thought it would be a big success, and by a big success, I forecast 14 months. I certainly had no idea that it was going to make world theatrical history. There came a point in its history, I suppose after 5 or 6 years, when it became the longest-running play this country's ever known, when it was a question of perpetual motion. I mean, it became one of the sights of London, like Buckingham Palace, the Tower of London. The tourists flocked to see it. Children, when they became of mousetrap age, whatever that is, 9 or 10, came to see it, and their brothers had to come and see it. But what made it reach that point of no return, I don't know. People like it, but they like a lot of plays. Now, of course, it's a freak, and people like seeing freaks. I think this is a rather gentle form of murder. There is nothing grisly or gruesome. There's nothing to make anybody have nightmares. It's a puzzle. It has all the ingredients of the best of all quiz programs. It's a puzzle, it has comedy, it has drama, it's a guessing game, and the whole family can see it. I don't think this is the answer as to why it's run so long, but this is why people like it, and they tell their friends, and the friends see it, and so it goes on.
Whatever the reason, The Mousetrap has become a theatrical phenomenon. After it had chalked up its first decade, the first 10 years of continuous performance, the BBC sent a reporter down to the theatre to talk to the author herself, who wasn't giving away a word more than she meant to.
Do you often go to see your own plays? How often have you seen The Mousetrap?
Oh, about 40 or 50 times, I think.
Do you ever find that you forget the plot? Wonder who did it?
No, I can't say that.
What's your recipe for a successful thriller?
I wouldn't know.
Somebody's quoted you as saying that you get your best plots at the kitchen sink. Does this mean that murder is to you a cosy subject?
No, I don't think so. I think that if you're doing something rather monotonous that doesn't require much thought, you very often get ideas coming into your head, really.
Violent ideas?
No, just ideas about your work. They needn't be violent. Neat tricks, I should describe them as, more than...
Well, most of your violence is, I think, polite and certainly polished. What do you think of the modern sex and sadism school?
Well, I don't like it very much. Too old, I expect. I think it's rather like reading a medical book, you know, rather dull catalogue.
The same interviewer had rather more luck when he talked to one of the original stars of the show, Richard Attenborough.
Richard Attenborough, you were in the first production of The Mousetrap. How long was it before you managed to free yourself?
Well, I was able to free myself after 6 months, but I in fact stayed for nearly 2 years.
Have you ever returned to the scene of the crime since you left it?
Yes, about 6.5 years ago.
What did you think?
I thought it was magnificent theatre. It's most skillfully written, you know. It's incredibly skillfully written.
That's the secret of its success and long run.
Well, I think anybody would be a fool who didn't admit that one of the reasons for its long run is that it's in a comparatively small theatre. I think if it had been playing in Theatre Royal Drury Lane, you know, it wouldn't have run so long, obviously.
Of course, as we've heard, there have been other successful Christie plays, and Nigel Stock had the lead in one of them. But what did he think of the characters? Were they taken from Stock, or did they have a three-dimensional life of their own?
There was no depth. You see, they all appeared to be sort of stock characters. I mean, the major was very much the major. The butler was Jeevesian, but with very much sort of, well, Murder in the Crypt tones, you know what I mean? But very difficult to act, I thought. And the only way you could do that was just simply to forget about any sort of cardboard quality and just go in and try and make it into somebody of flesh and blood.
We're still a long way from finding out just how she does it. Those neat, easy-to-read stories of death on the vicarage lawn or just behind the rhododendron beds or on the golf links. Julian Simmons defines the classic Agatha Christie whodunit.
You have a group of suspects who are all in the same, who are all in the same social category. That is to say, you will very likely have the local doctor, the local solicitor, and the local squire will be the three essential figures. What makes it then is that the body is found in the library, and there are lots of clues, and there is a confrontation at the end. So on. This is the formula, but of course that doesn't mean that she sticks to that formula in the rigid way that I'm suggesting. You can see though a perfect instance of it in Murder on the Orient Express, where essentially this pattern is being fulfilled. It's perfectly true. It isn't in a library, it's in a train, it's on the Orient Express. But the suspects are all gathered together. There has to be the private detective, in this case Poirot, sometimes Miss Marple, to solve the crime. And there has to be, my word, isn't there, in Murder on the Orient Express, a really gigantic session at the end with Poirot saying, it might be you, it might be you, it might be you, but... So that's the essential Agatha Christie pattern.
What does the author herself have to say about it? As one might expect from what we've heard of her, she's bland, down-to-earth, matter-of-fact, as she describes her early efforts.
I found myself making up stories and acting the different parts, and there's nothing like boredom to make you write. So by the time I was 16 or 17, I'd written quite a number of short stories and one long, dreary novel. By the time I was 21, I'd finished the first book of mine ever to be published, The Mysterious Affair at Stiles. I'd sent it to one or two publishers who didn't want it, and eventually it went to John Lane. About a year later, I heard it had been accepted. Well, that's how it began, and since that time, I've written something like 55 books and half a dozen plays.
But no, it really won't do. There's more to it than that. Not everyone who's sat down at the typewriter has managed to turn out even a moderately successful whodunit, let alone book after book, year after year, in the way that The Mousetrap goes on season after season. Mitchell Raper talked about her selling power to the manager of a leading West End bookshop.
She's the only writer whose books we would buy without any question. It isn't when we hear of a new book of Christie's, we simply buy it, and buy it again, and buy it again. There's never a bad Christie book as far as sales are concerned. Other writers, of course, one has to be fairly careful because you can never be sure how they go. But there is a great Christie following, and we know that we get a lot of people who are customers of Mowbray's, and they come back and come back again for Christie novels.
Is there such a thing as a typical Christie buyer, a typical Christie customer?
Well, as far as I'm concerned, I seem to sell most Christie novels, in hardback that is, anyway, to middle-aged men. Whether that says very much about her readership or not, I can't say, but that's the sort of typical customer that's in my mind.
Have you yourself ever read an Agatha Christie novel?
Yes, when I was about 19 or 20, which is a fair while ago now, I read my first Agatha Christie and got hooked. In other words, I had read other crime novels for what I thought then was light relief, but always of very different authors. Once I'd read a Christie, I wanted to read more, and in fact for a period of 5, 6, 7 years, if ever I read a crime novel, it was one of Agatha Christie's.
What did you like about her?
The characters she created and the situations that she wrote about were totally believable. In other words, it was very easy to believe the plot, if you like. There was nothing fantastic to me about anything she wrote. It could have happened just around the corner or in one's own home sometimes.
So booksellers like the sound of her name, quite apart from the encouraging rattle of the till. The bookseller said that he sold a lot of her books to middle-aged men. One customer he obviously hadn't come across was 7-year-old Matthew Woolard, who at a remarkably early age is gorging himself on Hercule Poirot the way some children attack ice lollies.
How old were you when you read your first Agatha Christie?
2 or 3 months ago.
And how old were you then?
7 3/4, because I was just 4 weeks ago.
Which book did you read first?
Murder on the Orient Express.
And why did you choose that one?
Well, I had seen the film.
And you enjoyed the film, obviously.
Yes.
What do you like about the mysteries which she writes?
Well, you don't know the murder until the end, one. And two, they give you just about the right amount of clues. Not too many and not enough, if you know what I mean.
Do they scare you?
No.
And have you ever been able, in any of the books that you've read of hers, to spot who's done the murder before?
Yes, in Nemesis and Death in the Sky.
You got the murderer?
Yes, but I'm in the middle of both of them.
What other books of hers have you read?
Elephants Can Remember, and I'm reading Poirot's early cases, as well as Nemesis and Flight.
Would you like to write detective stories yourself?
I wouldn't know.
What do your parents think about it?
My mother thinks it's all right. She's read all of them. My father, he likes them, but not too much. He's only read 3 of them.
And what do you enjoy most about them?
That the murders are done in a good way, and they've been done properly, if you know what I mean.
But we're still looking for the secret of her success. Is there a secret? Is it simply that she begins leading you into the heart of the mystery before you're even aware of it? I think it was Ian Fleming who said that the formula of success was to make the reader reach the bottom of the page and then turn over to the next one. Perhaps the secret, one of the secrets of Dame Agatha's magic formula, is to start a little further back, to make sure that after you've read the first sentence at the top of the page, you go on reading the second and then the third, and never mind turning the page, because you've already been hooked. Here's how she begins one of her most popular books.
It is difficult to know quite where to begin this story, but I have fixed my choice on a certain Wednesday at luncheon at the vicarage. I had just finished some boiled beef when I remarked in a most unbecoming spirit that anyone who murdered Colonel Prothero would be doing the world at large a service. My nephew Dennis said instantly, "That'll be remembered against you when the old boy is found bathed in blood."
That came, needless to say, from Murder at the Vicarage. And here's another.
It was in the June of 1935 that I came home from South America. It had been a difficult time for us out there, and I need hardly say that one of my first reactions on reaching England was to look up my old friend, Hercule Poirot.
Ah, Poirot. Now we know that we're in safe hands right through that unpleasant business of the ABC murders. Another one? A typical Christie beginning, this, the opening sentences of The Murder of Roger Ackroyd, one of her very best, and certainly one of the cleverest.
Mrs. Ferrers died on the night of the 16th, 17th September, a Thursday. I was sent for at 8 o'clock on the morning of Friday the 17th, but there was nothing to be done. She had been dead for some hours. I am not going to pretend that at that moment I foresaw the events of the next few weeks, but my instinct told me that there were stirring times ahead.
I suppose everyone has their favourite Christie. Some like the Hercule Poirot stories more than Miss Marple. Some like Miss Marple more than Poirot. It hardly matters. The one quality she has, which matters more than any other, is the quality known as unputdownability. Here's writer Julian Simmons.
My own favourite is The Murder of Roger Ackroyd. This is an early Christie, published in 1926. And it really, it's so marvellously skilful. One mustn't give away the secret of it now, but I think one ought to go on to say, I mean, she doesn't actually like that very much. When the murder of Roger Ackroyd is mentioned, she says, oh dear, surely I've written something better than that. But all the books written between, I suppose, about 1932 and 1950 are really, as I say, absolutely dazzling. The skill of this, the skill with which she shows you the Ace of Spades, and then she turns over the card and it turns out to be the Queen of Diamonds. That is her essential skill, a sort of conjuring skill. The skill with which she does that in half a dozen books, like the ABC Murders, Ten Little Niggers, and so on, is really astonishing.
And the elusive secret of her astonishing success? A final comment from Nigel Stark and Dame Agatha herself.
Well, I think the answer to that, I presume to say so, is that a chessboard has so many squares on it. There are no more than those. And I think this is the way Dame Agatha works. I think that she knows that there are certain rules, there's a certain format which she has adopted usually throughout all her works, and it's extremely ingenious piece of chess play. That's the way I feel about it.
I do find that one's friends are curious about the way one works. What is your method, they want to know? Well, the disappointing truth is that I haven't much method. I type my own drafts on an ancient but faithful machine I've owned for years, and I find a dictaphone useful for short stories or for recasting an act of a play, but not for the more complicated business of working out a novel. No, I think the real work is done in thinking out the development of your story and worrying about it until it comes right. That may take quite a while. Then when you've got all your materials together, as it were, all that remains is to try to find time to write the thing. 3 months seems to me quite a reasonable time to complete a book, if one can get right down to it. On the other hand, plays, I think, are better written quickly. And of course, writing plays is much more fun than writing books. You haven't got to bother about long descriptions of places and people, or about deciding how to space out your material. And you must write pretty fast, to keep in the mood, and to keep the talk flowing naturally.
She cared about the country, and what one might think of as country values.
But she wasn't the sort of person to have lived in any kind of contact with squalor or sordidness, you know.
What she really believed very strongly was in the moral lessons of her books rather than the immoral lessons.
She told me once, matter of fact, rather sweetly, "Nothing immoral in my books, only murder."
Women of Mystery, a five-part investigation into women crime writers and their books, written and presented by Jessica Mann. Part 1, The Queen of Crime.
Agatha Christie, Dorothy L. Sayers, Marjorie Allingham, Nio Marsh, Josephine Tay. I could spend the whole programme listing the women whose bourgeois backgrounds and peaceful personalities might make them seem the very last people who would concentrate on crime and violence. Yet they did. And perhaps even more remarkable, those are the books that have survived, that have remained in print and been available to the general reader, some for more than half a century. Why is it that respectable English ladies are so good at murder? Why is there a well-known stereotype of the mystery writer as middle-aged, middle-class, and female? What is the link between such people and their apparently incongruous subject? I've been conducting my own investigation, and I find that many of these writers had much in common with each other. They were conservative, conformist, and conventional. They had no experience of crime. Agatha Christie is the perfect example of this type, and much that's said about her could be said of her colleagues. But Julian Simmons, who is a historian of the crime novel, believes that in one respect at least, she was unique.
Their lasting qualities are not equal. When, a few years ago, I was editing the crime series for Penguin, this was one of the things we found. To reprint an Agatha Christie is, in the good old phrase, like a license to print money. It really is. To reprint Marjorie Allingham and Josephine Tay, well, we did that. And they did quite reasonably well, but they didn't do anything like Agatha Christie. I mean, when I say nothing like, I mean not a tenth or a fifteenth or a twentieth, probably, of the sales of Agatha Christie.
The author of that license to print money was born in 1890 in that mecca of the bourgeoisie, Torquay. She never rebelled against the lessons of her childhood. As her biographer, Janet Morgan, found, it was a peaceful one.
She cared about the country and what one might think of as country values, sort of steadiness and honesty and an unfrenzied attitude and pace. I think that it's very important part of her psychology that she was born and brought up and always preferred to live in Devon, really very much removed from the metropolis. Her roots were in a rural and rather tranquil. I think she believed in tranquility. She cared about tranquility.
Most people found their tranquility shattered in 1914. During the war, Agatha Christie became a dispenser in the Torquay Hospital and used the knowledge she acquired in her first story, The Mysterious Affair at Stiles. She wrote it to amuse herself, in the same way Nio Marsh was to write her first story just for fun, and with the same self-deprecation as Dorothy Sayers, who wrote to her parents, "I have written a silly book." By the time The Mysterious Affair at Stiles was accepted by a publisher, Agatha had almost forgotten about it. She'd married an airman, Archie Christie, had a daughter called Rosalind, and was happy as a wife and mother. Writing was only a hobby, as she said in her autobiography.
Writing stories took the place of embroidering cushion covers or pictures taken from Dresden flower paintings. The creative urge can come in any form. The only difference is that you can be a good deal more grand about some of these things than others.
Thinking about murder might not be grand, but it was profitable.
I didn't consider myself a bona fide author. I wrote things, yes, books and stories. They were published, and I was beginning to accustom myself to the fact that I could count on them as a definite source of income. But never, when I was filling in a form and came to the line asking for occupation, would it have occurred to me to fill it in with anything but the time-honoured married woman. I was a married woman. That was my status and my occupation. As a sideline, I wrote books. I never approached writing by dubbing it with the grand name of career. I would have thought it ridiculous.
Josephine Tay called writing her novels her yearly knitting. And the writing of detective novels never seemed to these women to be their real life work. Nio Marsh was far more interested in her work in the theatre, as the popularizer of Shakespeare in New Zealand. Dorothy Sayers would be outraged now to realise that she's remembered as a crime writer, not, as she would have wished, as the scholarly translator of medieval poetry, or perhaps as a lay theologian. And Agatha Christie's first priority was always her family, although she was already a successful writer by 1926, when she published her sixth book, The Murder of Roger Ackroyd. There was a lot of argument amongst mystery fans about its fairness, for the murderer turned out to be the narrator. Then sales boomed when Agatha's private life hit the headlines. Her mother had died, her husband had asked for a divorce. Agatha Christie disappeared. A highly publicised search took place, 15,000 people combing the downs, tracker dogs, spotter aeroplanes, Boy Scouts, even Dorothy Sayers and her current boyfriend joined the search. All Agatha wrote in her autobiography about the famous episode was typically unforthcoming.
After illness came sorrow, despair and heartbreak. There is no need to dwell on it.
Agatha had been brought up in a sort of Christian household, rather protected, and I think she'd never really met unhappiness. And her marriage to Christie was a love marriage, though she was warned about him that he was rather ruthless. And this dreadful thing happened. She had to go back down to the West Country to look after her mother, who was dying, and she said to her best friend, "You look after my husband while I'm away." See, when she came back, she found that her best friend had absolutely gone him. She went off in the motor car, and then she ultimately turned up at Harrogate in the hotel. But it was only after about 8 days that she was recognised, and when the waiter said, "But you're Agatha Christie," she said, am I? She'd completely lost her memory. And I think it was the deepest trauma.
This episode is famous, and there's been endless speculation about what really happened. Dr. Anthony Storr is a professional psychiatrist.
I was inclined to think that it was what we call a fugue. I mean, there are well-authenticated instances of people who find themselves far away from home, who can't remember how they got there. They're not very common, but nearly always what you find is that somebody has been in a situation which they find emotionally intolerable, and that this is simply a way of escaping from it. Now, it's possible that this episode, which I have heard described to me about Agatha Christie, it's possible that this episode was something of that kind, and that there was a genuine loss of memory for a short time. Certainly it did seem to follow on an emotional crisis in her life.
Janet Morgan has been allowed to read Agatha Christie's private papers.
I think that anything as major as that would influence the whole of the rest of one's life. I don't think it was just the disappearance. I think that it was the fact that that was the moment when she began to realise quite a lot of things which have to be realised at some time or another. Her mother died, remember, just before that. And the death of a mother, especially when the mother and daughter is attached as those two were, and it's all tied up too with a family home as well, which had to be packed up and dismantled. I think that was a very significant feature at this particular watershed in her life. She was also beginning to be professionally successful as well, and this was something really rather unexpected. And so it was a coming together of a lot of shocks. She became aware of quite a lot of different, rather unexpected things.
Despite her happy second marriage to the archaeologist Sir Max Mallowan, Dr. A.L. Rouse, who was a friend of them both, thinks that episode was the cause of her intense shyness.
I don't think that anybody knew her well, and because this is rather a clue to Agatha, she was deeply reserved because of that appalling experience that she'd had rather early in life. Agatha hated publicity. She'd never make a public speech. She'd never make a public appearance. She'd never allow herself to be interviewed. I'd been present at lectures that Max gave in Los Angeles, and everybody knew this most famous woman was there. But there she was sitting up against the wall. Nobody could see her very much, and all that happened was, when Max mentioned his wife, she very briefly got up and very politely curtsied and at once turned her face to the wall.
Agatha remained shy all her life. In her autobiography, she'd described how she'd had to abandon her hopes of a career on the concert platform because she was incapable, even as a girl, of facing an audience.
There was a party for the 10th anniversary of The Mousetrap. There had to be a party for it, and what is more, I had to go to the party. This was a grand, a super party at the Savoy. It had everything that is most awful about parties. Masses of people, television, lights, photographers, reporters, speeches, this, that and the other. Nobody in the world was more inadequate to act the heroine than I was. I started the party in an inauspicious manner. I had been asked to get to the Savoy half an hour before the scheduled time and arrived bravely alone. But when I tried to enter the private room reserved for the party, I was turned back. No admission yet, madam. Why couldn't I say outright, I am Mrs. Christie and I have been told to go in? I don't know.
This is an extreme example of a quality common to all these women mystery writers. They were all noticeably secretive about their personal lives. Indeed, I believe that their innate reticence, their unwillingness to expose themselves in their writing, was one of the reasons they chose to write in the mystery form.
Max once summed it up awfully well. On the outside, she was a person of great diffidence and modesty. But inside she had a sort of inner confidence and an inner strength, because I think she won through this awful experience. And it all worked out happily in the end.
In fact, of course, by the middle 1940s, she was an industry. And there were tremendous discussions about the precise form of adaptation for a film, or whether a particular type of title would suit the American market or not. When you are a writer, it's a sort of self-generating profession, partly because of unpleasant problems like income tax. Your earnings are spread, your advisors are advising you, and Agatha Christie, at one point certainly in her life, got into the most frightful complications, through no fault of her own, with the tax authorities in America.
Income tax worries became a common bugbear. Marjorie Allingham enjoyed herself in one book, making the accountant, who kept giving uncomfortable advice about tax dodges, the murder victim. Dorothy Sayers kept off that treadmill. After 9 crime novels, she stopped writing detective stories altogether and turned her energies to God and Dante. But Marsh, Allingham and Christie slogged on.
She was one of those people with a natural narrative gift, and superimposed on that this extraordinary ingenuity as regards plot. She may have read in a newspaper that an identical twin had been found murdered, or she might have paid a visit to her dentist and had the notion that you could base clues to a murder on identification by means of teeth. And she will, in her plotting notebook, you will then see 7 or 8 ideas, A, B, C, etc., on that theme, just jotted down, just pouring straight out, and she'll pick 1 or 2 of them and begin to work them up to herself. And then, maybe years later, she'll return to some of the others she discarded. She's rather like Handel. Nothing is ever wasted. There are never any leftovers. And she knew she could do this. I think she was conscious that she could tell a good story and put a twist in it. At the same time, she was curiously diffident and rather modest about her work.
All the real interest in Agatha's work is in the working out of the plot. She was constantly written to by admirers. You see, she had an enormous correspondence, and they were always sending her plots that they wanted her to write up. Agatha always used to reply, "Look, the only real pleasure that I get is in thinking out the plot beforehand. So you mustn't take away that pleasure from me, and all the rest is hard work and drudgery."
Agatha Christie described this hard work in her autobiography. She used to complain to Max that she would never manage it. At first he'd be sympathetic, but after a while he hardly raised his eyes from his potsherds to tell her that she'd said exactly the same thing last time. Agatha Christie put it into fiction. One of her favourite characters was based on herself, a mystery writer she named Mrs. Ariadne Oliver.
Mrs. Oliver, in a state apparently bordering on insanity, was prowling round the room, muttering to herself. She threw me a brief, uninterested glance and continued to prowl. Her eyes, unfocused, swept round the walls, glanced out of the window, and occasionally closed in what seemed to be a spasm of agony. "But why?" Mrs. Oliver demanded of the universe. "Why doesn't the idiot say at once that he saw the cockatoo? He couldn't have helped seeing it. But if he does mention it, it ruins everything. There must be a way. There must be." She groaned, ran her fingers through her short grey hair, and clutched it with frenzied hands. Then, looking at me with suddenly focused eyes, she said, "Hello, Mark, I'm going mad," and resumed her complaint. "And then there's Monica. Monica. I believe the name's wrong. Nancy. Would that be better? Joan. Everybody is always Joan. Anne is the same. Susan. I've had a Susan. Lucia. Lucia. Lucia, I believe I can see a Lucia. Red-haired, polo-neck jumper, black tights. Black stockings, anyway." This momentary gleam of good cheer was eclipsed by the memory of the cockatoo problem, and Mrs. Oliver resumed her unhappy prowling. "You know, Mark, I can't think how anyone gets away with murder in real life.
Say what you like. It's not natural for 5 or 6 people to be on the spot when B is murdered and all to have a motive for killing B, unless B is absolutely madly unpleasant, and in that case nobody will mind whether he's been killed or not and doesn't care in the least who's done it. I see your problem, I said. But if you've dealt with it successfully 55 times, you'll manage to deal with it once again. That's what I tell myself, said Mrs. Oliver. Over and over again. But every single time I can't believe it, and so I'm in agony.
The shy country lady has become the pivot of a major industry, not only as a detective novelist, but also as a playwright, though she'd only turned to writing plays for light relief.
Writing plays seemed to me entrancing simply because it wasn't my job, because I hadn't got the feeling that I had to think of a play. I only had to write the play I was already thinking of. Plays are much easier to write than books because you can see them in your mind's eye.
But even plays brought hard work in their wake.
Complications with theatrical agencies and theatres that either were or were not available, and the most wonderful dramas with the casts of her various plays who were extremely interesting and intriguing to her. She adored the theatre.
I think, without exception, all these ladylike crime writers adored the theatre. There's no greater contrast to the novelist's lonely workroom than backstage life. Dorothy Sayers became passionate about the stage when her first play was put on, and, of course, the theatre was Nio Marsh's lifetime profession. Agatha Christie had a Midas touch. Everyone knows that The Mousetrap has broken all records. As with so many crime writers, the greater the success, the more energetic the criticism. Highbrow critics branded Agatha Christie's books as unreadable, and even the people who do like them admit that the writing is wooden and the characters cardboard. But Julian Simmons doesn't agree.
One of the kind of tests that people give in a vague way about books is, well, will they last 50 years? Will they last half a century? And one comes up with a sense of shock against the fact that Agatha's books, her first book, The Mysterious Affair at Styles, was published in 1920, and sure enough, it's lasted for more than half a century. I would have said myself that the lasting quality in Agatha Christie's books is the absolutely marvellous skill with which, in the best books, the puzzles are created. That's the extra thing in her case. If you enjoy puzzles, and one part of humanity does, in a lot of moods, enjoy the setting and solving of puzzles, then if you're a master puzzle creator, then you've done something that is probably going to last.
I don't entirely agree with Julian Simmons. There were plenty of brilliant setters of puzzles whose detective stories have been completely forgotten. And the other women whose books have survived didn't concentrate on their plots. Dorothy Sayers was trying to write novels of manners combined with detective stories. Marjorie Allingham and Nio Marsh and Josephine Tay didn't write about cardboard characters. Their dialogue was not unspeakable, their scenery not imprecise. In such aspects, they were better than Agatha Christie. And their books have survived for the same half century. They were writing about a world readers found and find comforting. Comforting partly because they made it seem that even murder need not necessarily disrupt things permanently. Once the murderer had been arrested, or often in these books had committed suicide rather tidily, everybody else who'd been involved could go back to life as it had been before. And that life was one that urban critics disapproved of, despised, even disbelieved in, but that represented either an ideal or a reality to a lot of readers. It was middle class, conservative, both with a large and a small C, usually in the country. The rich man was in his castle, the poor man at his gate, and somewhere in between were the vicar, the colonel, the squire, the spinster, all those cartoon-like figures who really did exist in rural England, and I think still do.
I would say that she was somebody who lived the life of an English woman living in the country who was very domestic, who minded about order, domestic order, domestic harmony. There is a type of person who has old friends down to stay regularly, and the old friends come at the same time every year, and they know that they will have a very restful, pleasant time in a restful atmosphere with masses of bowls of flowers carelessly but beautifully arranged, and lavish and delicious and regular meals, and a little bit of croquet and a little bit of tennis and so on. And that was what you knew you would get with her. A feeling of... She was a serene person, and her surroundings were serene. And she was a serene country Englishwoman.
Like Agatha Christie, Marjorie Allingham lived the serene and hospitable life of a country Englishwoman, and Josephine Tay, a Scot, and Nio Marsh, a New Zealander, both loved rural England, and what they thought, idealistically or accurately, was its lifestyle. And that's what they described in their novels. But there is one major difference. In real life, serene country Englishwomen don't know much about violent crime. None of these women had any personal knowledge or experience of it. What they did know about was the violent emotions that people living respectable lives could feel. When Miss Marple was out solving murder cases, she was always drawing parallels with what had happened back home in St. Mary's Mead. Miss Marple was based on Agatha Christie's memories of her own grandmother, who'd always expected the worst of everyone and was always proved right. In Marguerite Laski's view, Agatha Christie was especially realistic, more realistic than some of the others, like, for instance, Nio Marsh.
She falls into that trap, which I think women more than men writers do fall into, of not wanting the really nice people to have done it. And so she comes down into the end of the servant. And this, I think, is what more than anything else mars Nio Marsh. You can always tell who's done a Nio Marsh, because it won't be one of the really nice people. And this, I think, was Agatha Christie's great strength. There were no holds barred. With her, it could be the little child, it could be the charming young girl, it could be the handsome young man, it could be the dear old lady. And I don't believe any other writer's been quite so ruthless.
She knew and was interested in how people live and how they behave. And one of the things that leads me to say that is the vast variety of acquaintance that she had. And they are scattered all over the world. They're in every profession. Some of them are really rather grand people, some of them not so grand. And she had a great breadth of interest and was very fascinated by how people lived and what they did. Now, you could say that, she was never a coal miner or a truck driver or whatever, but then how many of us are?
And she didn't write about coal miners or truck drivers. None of these women did. They wrote about a secure, comfortable world in which they lived themselves, which they thought was satisfactory, and for which many of their readers yearned. It cheered them up. That's probably why books by Agatha Christie were read in air raid shelters more than anything else.
They gave the public a cosy article, and a cosy article was what was wanted then, and to a lesser degree is still enjoyed now. Where the blood is so transparently paint, and where the brains coming out of the body are so transparently sawdust, one's not worried in the least. And the murder in the library is a very cosy article.
Mrs. Bantry was dreaming. Her sweet peas had just taken a first at the flower show. The vicar, dressed in cassock and surplice, was giving out prizes in church. Mrs. Bantry was enjoying her dream a good deal. She usually did enjoy these early morning dreams that were terminated by the arrival of early morning tea. But in her sleep, Mrs. Bantry frowned. Something disturbing was penetrating through to the dream state. Footsteps along the passage. Footsteps that were too hurried and too soon. Her ears listened unconsciously for the chink of china, but there was no chink of china. The knock came at the door. Automatically, from the depths of her dream, Mrs. Bantry said, "Come in." Out of the dim green light, Mary's voice came, breathless, hysterical. "Oh, ma'am! Oh, ma'am! There's a body in the library!"
Agatha Christie lived in a world where housemaids brought early tea to a mistress dreaming of flower shows throughout her 40 happy years with Max Mallowan. She lived like that until her death in 1976, writing her books and plays, and becoming one of the most famous women in the world. Agatha Christie was the epitome of the woman crime writer. Behind reserved and respectable facades, they all had murder in mind.
In Women of Mystery, Part 1, Jessica Mann talked to A.L. Rouse, Janet Morgan, Anthony Storr, Julian Simmons, and Margarita Lasky about the life and works of Agatha Christie. Readings were by Francis Jeter, and the title music by Jolyon Jackson. Women of Mystery was produced by Margaret Wyndham.
I'm Matthew Pritchard, grandson of Agatha Christie, and I'm delighted to introduce some excerpts of Agatha Christie's life in partnership with BBC Radio 4 Extra. This year is my grandmother's 125th anniversary, and I think it gives everybody, not only her family and people intimately concerned with Agatha Christie's work, cause to wonder that 125 years after she was born and nearly 40 years after she died, that so many people all over the world still regard her work as enjoyable, relevant, and that her characters still reach out from the page in a way that I think perhaps has not been achieved by anybody else who wrote at the same time as she did.
I don't think that I really considered myself as a bona fide author. I wrote things, yes, books and stories, and they were published. But never when I was filling in a form, passports or otherwise, and came to the line with occupation. It would never have occurred to me to fill it in with anything but the time-honoured married woman. Married woman was a profession in itself, and it was my profession. That was my status, that was my occupation. As a sideline, I wrote books. I must have been, I think, singularly unambitious at all times. I don't think I ever approached writing with the same exuberance and enthusiasm that I would have embarked on a career as a singer. But even then, I do not think I should have yearned for more than a reasonable success to be good at what I was doing, to be able to sing certain roles. I had never been able to see myself as the top of any career. "You write so well, Agatha, dear," my mother-in-law used to say to me. "Surely you ought to write something serious, something worthwhile," was what she meant. I would find it very difficult to explain to her, and indeed did not really try. But I was eminently a writer for entertainment.
My grandmother wrote the autobiography. It took her quite some time. It was almost a hobby for her, actually, in the 1960s. And as far as I know, she wrote the whole thing on audio tape, or one of those things with spools that you don't see any longer now. And it is a fascinating record, social history record of what happened in the 1890s and early 20th century. And something which I think could be read with that in mind, even if Agatha Christie hadn't been the famous person she became. And then, of course, it moves on through the various parts of her life, writing her first book and inventing Miss Marple.
I would not say that Miss Marple was in any way a picture of my grandmother. She was far more fussy and spinsterish than my grandmother was. I just had the idea, possibly it was for a series of 6 short stories for one special magazine, and I chose the people whom I thought would be suitable. An old spinster lady living in a village, the sort of old lady who would have been rather like some of my grandmother's cronies. People a little like the people I had met in the hotel at Skye. Old ladies like I had seen in the private hotel in South Kensington, and old ladies that I had met in so many villages when I had gone to stay. But she had this in common with my grandmother, that although a completely cheerful person, she always expected the worst of anyone and everything, and was with almost frightening accuracy usually proved right.
And the first Poirot, and how several publishers refused it, and eventually she found one who accepted it.
People never stop writing to me nowadays to suggest that Miss Marple and Hercule Poirot should meet. But why should they meet? I'm sure they would not like meeting at all. Hercule Poirot, the complete egoist, would not like being taught his business or having suggestions made to him by an elderly spinster lady. Hercule Poirot, a professional sleuth, would not be at home at all in Miss Marple's world. No, they are both stars, and they are stars in their own right. I shall not let them meet, unless I feel a very sudden and unexpected urge to do so.
I always think of her as a listener, so she sat there and listened, and whoever it was, whether it was her family or other writers or whoever, and I think the autobiography is a great record of that, because she heard everything, she saw everything, and she was very good at writing it down. I'm Matthew Pritchard. I'm the grandson of Agatha Christie. I was never there when she wrote books. Nobody but an idiot would try and write a complicated detective story with a 10-year-old grandson tugging at your heels.
Many of them said to me, I never know when you do write your books, because I've never really actually seen you writing them, or even seen you go away to write them. I think I must have behaved rather as dogs do when they retire with a bone. They depart in a rather secretive manner, and you do not see them again for an odd half hour. They return self-consciously with mud in their nose. I think I must have done much the same.
I mean, there is a sort of very short piece, which I think actually is in the BBC archive, in which she says that people keep on asking me how I write my books.
Yes, I do find that one's friends are curious about the way one works. What is your method, they want to know? Well, the disappointing truth is that I haven't much method. The real work is done in thinking out the development of your story and worrying about it until it comes right. That may take quite a while. Then when you've got all your materials together, as it were, all that remains is to try to find time to write the thing.
I think, strangely enough, she had more method than perhaps she would even admit herself, and the one thing that she did insist on was that she was alone when she wrote, because she felt that anything else was a distraction.
They all recognised the sounds when I was broody, and looked at me hopefully, and kindly urged me to shut myself up in a room somewhere. One wonders where these things come from. Sometimes I think it is the moment one feels nearest to God, because you have been allowed to feel a little of the joy of pure creation. You've been able to make something that is not yourself. You know a kinship with the Almighty, as you might on the seventh day, when you see that what you have made is good.
She was very confident. As far as I know, she never had an editor at Collins Publishers. She had very strong views, and I think the thing about her books that was sort of borne out by personal experience of her was the fact that the dialogue was almost perfect. And I think that even she realised, I mean, she didn't think she was Shakespeare or Conan Doyle or Dickens, who incidentally was one of her favourite authors, but she did think that she wrote realistic and good dialogue.
It is an odd feeling to have a book, as it were, growing inside you for perhaps 6 or 7 years on end, knowing that one day you will write it, knowing that it is building up, as it were, that another character involved comes more clearly out of the mist, finally knowing that all the people are there, ready, waiting. Waiting, as it were, in the wings to come onto the stage as their cues are called. And then, suddenly, to get the clear and sudden command. Now is when you're ready. Now you know all about it. Now is really now.
I think one of the reasons why it has survived until the 21st century is that it's adaptable, and by that I don't only mean adaptable into television and these days into other parts of the sort of digital world. I mean adaptability into different languages. And I think one of the most remarkable things, we were reading the other day as part of the 125th anniversary, some of the fan letters that she received over the course of her life, and they came from everywhere. I have been to her plays in Beijing and Shanghai and Paris and all over the world, and she still, even in a foreign language, is able to make you feel tense in a theatre, and people enjoy reading her books in, I forget how many languages it is now, but I think it's sort of approaching 100. Matthew Pritchard. I'm the grandson of Agatha Christie. My grandmother wrote the autobiography in the 1960s, and as far as I know, she wrote the whole thing on audio tape, and it's a fascinating panoply of the 20th century as seen from the eyes of an extremely observant person.
I do realise now, looking back over my war output, that I really produced an incredible amount of stuff during those years of war. I suppose because there was no distraction of a pleasant nature, and because one practically never went out in the evenings. I had written two books during the first years of the war. This was in anticipation of my being killed in the raids. It seemed to me in the highest degree likely. So as soon as I was settled in London and the bombing really started, I was determined that I would at any rate leave two books, one for Rosalind, which I wrote first, a book with Hercule Poirot in it, and one for Matthew with Miss Marple in it. It will cheer you up, I explained to them both, when you come back from the funeral, to think that you've got a nice couple of books, one belonging to each of you. And I must say, we all had to laugh at that prospect.
When I first heard it in her own voice, as you might imagine, made me feel somewhat eerie and emotional. Matthew Pritchard. I'm the grandson of Agatha Christie. My grandmother wrote the autobiography in the 1960s, and as far as I know, she wrote the whole thing on audio tape, and here is an excerpt from that autobiography, which I hope illustrates some of its finer qualities.
Thoughts come to one at such odd moments. When you are walking along the street and examining a hat shop of particular interest, suddenly a splendid idea comes into your head, and you think, now that would be a very neat way of covering up the crime so that nobody would get it too soon. Of course, all the practical details are still to work out, and the people have to seep slowly into your consciousness, but at any rate, you do jot it down in an exercise book. So far, so good. But what I invariably do is to lose the exercise book. I usually have about half a dozen on hand, and I used to make little notes in them for ideas that had struck me, or sometimes some particular poison or drug
or a clever little bit of swindling that one reads about in the paper. Of course, if I kept all these things neatly sorted and filed and labelled, would have saved me a lot of trouble. But it is a great pleasure sometimes, when you are looking through a haphazard pile of old notebooks, to find something scribbled down as H.B., August, and then a kind of sketch of a plot. It is something you've so much forgotten about that you can't even remember you ever wrote it down.
I'm Matthew Pritchard. I'm the grandson of Agatha Christie. I think her legacy is enjoyment, adaptability. I think one of the reasons why it has survived until the 21st century is that it's adaptable. And by that, I don't only mean adaptable into television and other parts of the sort of digital world. I mean adaptability into different languages. And I think one of the most remarkable things, we were reading some of the fan letters that she received over the course of her life, and they came from everywhere.
People never stop writing to me nowadays to suggest that Miss Marple and Hercule Poirot should meet. But why should they meet? I'm sure they would not like meeting at all. Hercule Poirot, the complete egoist, would not like being taught his business or having suggestions made to him by an elderly spinster lady. Hercule Poirot, a professional sleuth, would not be at home at all in Miss Marple's world. No, they are both stars, and they are stars in their own right. I shall not let them be, unless I feel a very sudden and unexpected urge to do so. She had been my favourite character, an acidulated spinster, full of curiosity, knowing everything, hearing everything, the complete detective service in the home. Certainly at the time, I had no intention of continuing her for the rest of my natural life.
I'm Matthew Pritchard. I'm the grandson of Agatha Christie. Some of what you hear in excerpts from the autobiography you won't have heard or read before, because she actually dictated more than was published. So, in a sense, you will be receiving something new.
I was gaining confidence over writing now. I felt that I would have no difficulty in producing a book every year, and possibly a few short stories as well. The really nice part about writing in those days was that you directly related writing to money. If you decided to write a story, you knew it would bring you in £60 or whatever it was. And you could in your mind deduct what income tax would be. This would directly pay the plumber's bill or the decorating bill or something that you wished to buy. This was very satisfactory and, of course, stimulated output enormously. If you said to yourself, I should like to take the conservatory down and fit it up as a loggia instead on which we could sit, how much will that be? You got your estimate. You went to your typewriter. You sat, thought, advised, and planned. And within a week, a story was formed in your mind, and you wrote it. And of course, you had your loggia. How different from the last 10 or 20 years of my life. I never know what I owe. I never know what money I have. I never least know what money I shall have. And anyone who is looking after my income tax is always arguing about 6 years previously, which has not yet been agreed. What can one do in circumstances like this? Oh yes, that was the happy and plutocratic time.
I'm Matthew Pritchard. I'm the grandson of Agatha Christie. My grandmother wrote the autobiography in the 1960s, and as far as I know, she wrote the whole thing on audio tape, and here is an excerpt from that autobiography.
My literary activities at this period seem curiously vague and sketchy in my memory. I don't think, even by that time, that I really considered myself a bona fide author. I wrote things, yes, books and stories, and they were published. And I was beginning to accustom myself to the fact that I could count upon them as a definite source of income. But never when I was filling in a form, passports or otherwise, and came to the line with occupation, it would never have occurred to me to fill it in with anything but the time-honoured married woman. Married woman was a profession in itself, and it was my profession. That was my status, that was my occupation. As a sideline, I wrote books. I must have been, I think, singularly unambitious at all times. I don't think I ever approached writing with the same exuberance and enthusiasm that I would have embarked on a career as a singer. But even then, I do not think I should have yearned for more than a reasonable success to be good at what I was doing, to be able to sing certain roles. I had never been able to see myself as the top of any career.
Audible hopes you've enjoyed this programme.